Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program designed to look at the economic dimensions of our lives, our debts, our incomes, our jobs, our prospects. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life, currently teach at the New School University in New York City. We also maintain a couple of websites that I'm going to tell you more about as we go through the program, but first I want to draw you in by showing you the kind of work we do if you're not familiar and getting us into it if you are. So we start with short updates, and I wanted to bring several to your attention today. The first one has to do with a kind of interesting phenomena that happened, well, it built over a long time, but it happened in this month of December 2014. And it happened in Eugene, Oregon, and it happened at the University of Oregon that is located there. The graduate teaching assistants, and I'm going to tell you in a moment what that means, the graduate teaching assistants at that university went on strike at the beginning of the month, December 1st. And they demanded supports of a variety of kinds. They felt they were overworked and underpaid. And as you'll see in a minute, that's an understatement of what their condition actually is. Unlike other strikes in recent years, the teaching assistants at the University of Oregon were successful. It took a few weeks, but they won their strike. The university provided them with the following: a special fund to handle medical emergencies and maternity leaves for students when they had children, $1,000 for a medical leave and $1,500 for a maternity leave. Now, that's not much by international standards. In most countries, workers are required to be paid under such circumstances much larger sums of money. Unfortunately, in the United States, being one of the few countries that doesn't have that, we don't get that kind of benefit unless workers strike for it or press employers for it. And in this case, the teaching assistants did that. And the second thing the teacher assistants got is a 5% per year increase in their salaries this year and next. So a two-year contract with 5% per year increases in each year, according to the Associated Press story on this successful strike. What are graduate teaching assistants? Well, here's what they are, and they're a glimpse into what's happening to American colleges and universities. It used to be that you hired a professor. You hired a person who had shown that he or she could learn a great deal, go through the levels of a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and then a PhD doctorate, acquire the knowledge, the skill, the background, to then be put into a classroom as a skilled person to teach America's college-age young people. In other words, you paid for a skilled teacher. As colleges have been underfunded by the public, since more than three-quarters of our college and university students in America go to public schools, as the public support for higher education, as it's called, shrank in the United States, well then, not so surprisingly, the university began to function more like a business. Indeed, the people who sit on the boards of most universities are businessmen and women who think, unfortunately, that how you run a business is ought to be how you run a university, although why that should be the case is one of the great mysteries of modern time. In any case, to save money, it was decided, let's pay a graduate student, a student studying to become a professor. Let's say to the graduate students, instead of, as we once did, giving you a scholarship so you could learn and focus on that, we're not going to do that anymore. The only way we're going to give you the money you need to get your degree is if you teach along the way, and we're not going to give you very much money for teaching, far less than we used to pay the professor. This was a businessman or woman's idea. You get the person, the live body in the classroom, teaching, but pay a lot less. isn't that a cost saving? The answer is, yes, it's a cost saving. But instead of an experienced, trained person with real capability, you have a student who's just learning, who hasn't even figured out yet whether he or she wants this as a permanent job, can do it well as a permanent job. The quality of education is unquestionably deteriorated. But you saved money. Very strange logic, but it's business calculation, and that's what universities do. So you pay them very little, and you try to squeeze more out of them, and you have them sort of because they have to stay there, they have to finish their studies, they don't want to offend anybody, they're waiting to get their degree. So you got much more control over them than over a senior professor who has his or her degree. Sad comment on what passes for education. Kudos to the teaching assistants in Oregon who don't want to be abused in this way much more. Well, it's Christmas, isn't it? So here's a Christmas economic update. The city of San Jose, California, decided in this month of Christmas to evict 300 homeless people from a tent city that they had erected along the banks of a river in San Jose. According to the National Coalition of the Homeless, who have a researcher named Chris Herring, who wrote the report, the eviction of these 300 people, included quite a few children, is a kind of assault on what he estimates are 5,000 unsheltered people in the city of San Jose. And he also cites the fact that there are over 100, maybe even more than 200 tent cities all over Santa Clara County, housing varying numbers of homeless people. It's a sad commentary on the United States that there are homeless people. It's a sad commentary that so little is done for them in a community and solidary way that they have to scramble to produce tent cities. And then even when they're there and their situation is clear to everybody, the response is not only not to solve their problem, but simply to evict them, which simply means that they must move now somewhere else. Is this the Christmas spirit that our economic system enables us? It's being reproduced all over the country. It's not unique to San Jose. It's not unique to Santa Clara County or California. It's a commentary on an economic recovery that has bypassed these people even more severely than it has bypassed so many others. Next update, good news, if you like, at least better news, comes out of the United Kingdom, where the Labour Party, which has hardly been known for progressive breakthroughs in the recent past, or for that matter, for decades now, has decided it can do something in an area that desperately demands it, and not only in Great Britain, but in the United States and many other countries. This has to do with the extraordinary phenomena known as internships. Internships is that word we have come to use for the situation when you have a lot of unemployment, when employers can pretty much call the shots because there are so many desperate people looking for work relative to the number of jobs available. That's been the situation, particularly in the United States and Great Britain, but in other countries as well. And employers have not been shy of taking advantage of how this capitalist system delivers an opportunity to them. So here's what they've done. They've told young people, you're desperate for a job, aren't you? And you're hoping to outcompete another person, likewise desperate for a job. So here's what we offer you. You come and work for us. We won't pay you a nickel, but we'll write you a lovely letter when you're done, and you can put on your resume that you were an intern at our firm, and we'll claim that you worked and learned something here. Because young people are desperate to get jobs, because they hope and believe that being an intern looks good on your resume and gives you a leg up on the next person who didn't get one, young people are doing this, and some not so young people also. And of course, employers are exploiting this situation. They're basically getting more and more people for no pay, often in violation of existing laws. The Guardian, a very good and creative newspaper in Great Britain, recently did a global survey of many countries and found out that 1 in 3 of these kinds of folks earn nothing. There are some interns who get a little bit, but we're talking about 1 in 3 who get absolutely nothing for their work. 74% of British citizens polled said no one in their family could ever afford to be an intern because they can't go for months and months with no income. So internships turn out to be not only a ripoff of workers by employers, but a massive discrimination in favor of wealthier young people looking for work at the expense of middle and lower income. Why? Because the wealthier student gets the support from his or her family that will allow them to have an apartment and buy food for the months of working as an intern without pay, whereas a middle and lower income person can't afford it. So internships really are bad. So now, what has the Labour Party in England done? They have proposed a law. Now, they are the minority party in Great Britain at the moment, so their proposing it is far from getting it into the statute books. But at least it shows a recognition of the outrage that internships represent, of a capitalist system that is treating a mass, particularly of younger workers, in an awful and unjustifiable way. The Labour Party has proposed a law that you can't do more than 4 weeks of unpaid internship. It doesn't eliminate it, which is the courageous and appropriate thing to do, but it is at least the beginning of a recognition that this is an abuse that the system imposes and ought not to be allowed to continue. While we're on the subject of universities as businesses and in Britain, another story that came from Britain this last week that I wanted to bring to your attention, and also coming from the newspaper The Guardian. Tremendous uproar in British universities, and by the way, the same is true in the United States and other countries, that more and more faculty are not being hired because of the quality of their teaching. They're not being hired because of the creativity of the questions they ask. They're being hired or retained, if they have a job, based on a ruthless criterion, which is now explicit in universities because their conversion into businesses is so far along. They're being hired or retained based on how many dollars or British pounds of grants they're bringing in to the university. In other words, the university doesn't care whether you're creative or good as a teacher, or they're interested in how much money can you get from private corporations or from government agencies to fund your research. And the reason for that is the university always takes a hefty chunk of whatever a professor gets for itself to run the university. The professor only gets a portion of whatever the grant is. So that's the new rule. And professors are being denied jobs, not hired in the first place, not because their work isn't creative, not because they aren't fantastic teachers by every metric for that we have, but because they're not bringing in enough money. And there was a real scandal earlier this fall when Stefan Grimm, a well-known scientist in Britain, killed himself, committed suicide, and left an unmistakable level of evidence as to why. Even a message. I can't live under the pressures and the bullying. My work suffers. My life suffers. I quit. It was a very moving treatment of this case in the Times Higher Education Supplement, that's the Times of London, on the 3rd December of this year, written by Chris Parr. I want to turn from the discussion of short updates to a response to some of the questions you have posed in recent communications to us. Several of you have asked me to resume what I used to do more of, and perhaps I'll have to think about doing more of it again. But you asked me to talk about successful examples in the world today of worker co-ops, or what we prefer to call workers' self-directed enterprises, these new non-capitalist ways of organizing business enterprises, factories, offices, stores, whatever. Non-capitalist, why? Because instead of having shareholders and the board of directors that the shareholders select, who make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Instead of that, we have a worker co-op. The workers become their own bosses. There are no shareholders, or if they are, it's the workers themselves. And there is no board of directors, or if there is, it's the workers themselves. You know, the workers come to work Monday to Thursday and do a particular task the way they always did, and they come on Friday and they have meetings to decide collectively and democratically, one worker, one vote, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that they all help to produce. That is a democratic enterprise. Capitalism doesn't organize its enterprises democratically. It refuses, that's what capitalism means, to do that. It keeps the decision-making in the hands of shareholders and boards of directors. The vast majority of workers own no shares and do not participate on the board of directors. They are excluded from the decisions that affect their lives every day on the job. So we talk about democratic enterprises, worker co-ops, worker self-directed enterprises, and your questions have been to talk about examples. So I picked one for today in response to your questions. Here we go. The name of this one is called SUMA, S-U-M-A, SUMA. It is a wholesale producer of foods, particularly organic health foods. It's located in the West Yorkshire area of Great Britain. It's a cooperative. It has in it 200 workers. It's been going since 1976, where it has grown across this period of time. It is now very successful. Last year, it did over 34 million pounds. That's better than $50 million in U.S. Worth of business. That's a sizable company. This is a remarkable success story of a worker co-op that outcompetes its capitalist counterparts, that has grown as fast or better than many of them. It's a success. But I picked it for another reason, because it is unusual among worker co-ops. That is, the norm among worker co-ops is to decide that different workers, depending on the skills they bring, depending on the education they may have had, are assigned different levels of pay. Normally, in worker co-ops, the range from the top to the bottom is much narrower than you have in a capitalist corporation. For example, in the United States, big corporations can have the top executive get 300 times what the lowest paid worker does, or sometimes even more. Whereas the largest worker co-op, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, has a rule that nobody can get more than 8.5 times what anybody else gets. So co-ops are always much less unequal. But the SUMA Corporation in West Yorkshire, Britain, this successful 200-person co-op, has taken that a step further. They have, and I believe this is true from their beginnings, paid all the workers exactly the same. They have had a policy of equality. And currently, they pay their workers £13 an hour. That's better than $20 an hour. per person. And at the end of this last year, they all got a month's pay as a bonus. So they got basically an extra 12% on top of that. So that would work out, if you figure it out, to $23 or $24 per hour in U.S. currency, etc. They have found that to be a very successful way. They've had no trouble getting more people to work there. They've had no trouble growing. They've been a successful, expanding business. Worker co-ops are feasible. They can compete. They can compete successfully. They can grow over time. They can provide secure employment, and they can pay decently. All the things that are often said they cannot do, I will show you in this discussion now and in others to come, are not correct. Co-ops exist around the world and prove the viability and the feasibility of this kind of enterprise. And I leave it to all of you to think about whether or not you would rather work in a place where you can decide democratically what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that your work helps to generate, or whether you would like to go to a place where somebody else, whom you do not know, whom you did not elect, and over whom you exercise no real control, tells you what to do and takes the fruit of your labor as fast as you produce it. Let me turn to a question now that has also come from you with increasing frequency. And this is a question to talk about the military. As one of you put it in a colorful email to me, why, you wrote, do you not speak about the elephant in the living room? That's that old idea that people are having a hard time communicating in a living room, because in the middle of the living room is an elephant, which means you can't see the person you're trying to talk to on the other side of the elephant, or you can't hear him or her, and you keep trying without telling the other people, look, why don't we remove the elephant, and then we can talk much more easily. It pays to recognize and deal with the elephant in the living room. And the questions you've asked me basically can reduce to this. Isn't military spending the economic elephant in the economic living room? Okay, let's talk about it. You're quite right. I don't give it enough attention. Unfortunately, it's one of several topics to which we simply do not have enough time to give the attention they deserve. So I'm now going to rely on the example of the United States, since it is more active militarily around the world than any other country, something that has been true for a long time, and spends a wild amount of money. And I'm going to take this, today's analysis, with my cap off to the Financial Times, a very important newspaper for all economists. The issue of December 14th was devoted to military spending in the United States, and particularly to the costs of the wars in Afghanistan and the wars in Iraq. So let's go. The estimates, these are very hard to come by. The United States government has been very leery and hesitant to provide reliable estimates, which is one of the reasons why the estimates vary a bit. The Financial Times estimates are conservative. I've seen estimates as high as $4 trillion as the cost over the last 10 or 15 years of the American military activities. The Financial Times, a little more circumspect, they priced the cost of the Afghanistan war as, to date, $1 trillion. And the cost of the Iraq war at $1.7 trillion. In other words, the two wars together are pushing $3 trillion. And they point out, as all efforts to calculate the cost of war have to do, that these are preliminary estimates because one of the biggest expenses of the war is going to play itself out over the next 20 and 30 years. I'm talking about all of the returning military personnel who are coming back with traumatic physical injuries, traumatic mental injuries, and who will require vast amounts of support in the form of pensions, medical care, Veteran Administration services, Veteran Administration hospitals, and so on. We know that it will be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. We just don't know how much. We can't at this point. And we don't really know for how long these will ramify. So we're talking vast amounts of money. But let's go back just to the Afghanistan war. It is the longest war in American history. And remember, I'm only looking at the economics of these things. I'm not here to talk about the political, moral, ethical. Those are very important. That's not what this program focuses on. The longest war in the United States, now costing $1 trillion. Here's some interesting facts about that. If you adjust for prices, we're spending more on that war than we spent on the Marshall Plan after World War II, says the Financial Times. They did the calculation. $1 trillion. Give you an idea of what that might mean in the United States. $1 trillion is about, currently, the total student debt of the United States. In other words, had the United States made a different decision not to fight a war in Afghanistan starting shortly after 9/11, that's why it's 13 years old, and that's why it's the longest war in the United States' history. If we had decided not to do that, we could go to the hundreds of thousands of American students now deciding not to go on with their education because they've got too many debts, deciding not to get married, not to have children, not to go to the field of study that they are passionately interested in, where they would be wonderfully creative, but instead to take a job quickly because of all these debts. We could have gone to that enormous swath of our citizenry and said to them, Jubilee, no debts, canceled. The government of the United States, as the representative of the people of the United States, says to the young people who are studying, we want your creativity, we want your passion, we want to help, we want to have a more educated society, and we think that's more important than fighting a war in Afghanistan. A war that in almost every country on earth, and indeed a majority of Americans say the same, we should never have entered in the first place. So there's no notion that this was a good idea that is dominant. There's no notion that the United States has won. The number of people who believe that is a very small minority. But we're looking at money spent that is staggering. It reminds me of the old remark that is as valid today as it ever was, that the issue war raises is always guns or butter. The money you spend on guns is not available to spend on butter. The money spent on Afghanistan, $1 trillion and counting, and Iraq, $1.7 trillion and counting, was money not made available to deal with poverty, to deal with student indebtedness, to deal with a broken infrastructure, to deal with re-equipping our enterprises so they could compete in a world economy. Lots of things that we could list, that every one of you listening or watching could list, that you might prefer to see that kind of money spent on? That, because those are sums that could transform a society. That's why I gave the example of student debt. But instead, we had war. And why? Because we've made it a taboo in the United States to question it. The government budget, like it did this last couple of weeks, goes through. The military is barely discussed. We can't. We can't question it. We can't debate it. The details, yes, but not the basic idea, not these trillions. The money flows. Guns it is. But we can't afford food stamps, and we can't afford helping our students in debt, and we can't afford, and we can't afford, but we can afford those wars. Think about it. It is an elephant in the room. And when you have that big an elephant, and when you say, hey, get out so we can communicate, the elephant kicks back and says, no, I'm a big elephant. I can push you out of the room. The military don't want to be constrained. And all the companies that make money off of them don't want to be constrained. And all the states that get money because they have a military base, they don't want. So we have in the, spread across the United States the structure, what President Eisenhower once called the military-industrial complex, to hold on. But it's not rational for this society, and it's long overdue to open up a real discussion about the real elephant right in the middle of our room. This is Richard Wolff. We're at the middle of our program. This is Economic Update. We're going to take a short break, and then I ask you to rejoin me for the second half of our program.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. You better stop the things you do. I tell you, I ain't lying. You know I can't stand it. You're running around. You know better, daddy. I can't stand it because you put me down. Oh, no. I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
Welcome back, everyone, to Economic Update, the second half of our edition for Christmas time 2014. Before we jump into the major topics for today's program, which have to do with wealth and poverty in the United States, a topic that you send me countless questions, I want to talk a little bit about the questions and this program just for a moment. We maintain two websites, rdwolf with two f's.com and democracyatwork.info. Both are available to you 24/7 without any charge whatsoever. They are filled with archives of all of these programs. You can listen to any or all of them all the way back to March 2011 when we began. It is also filled with written work, audio tapes of various kinds, and videos of talks I've given, research we've done, a wonderful treasure trove of material on the economic dimensions of what is going on in the United States and the larger world. I think you will find it fascinating. That's why we produce it. But the two websites give you two further capabilities, actually three, that I would like to bring to your attention. The first is a way to communicate with me and with our team. Tell us what you like, don't like about the program. Pose questions. We always answer two or three questions on the program. We cannot answer all of them. We get too many, for which we are grateful. But I want to urge you to use the websites for that. Second, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Ways to keep up with us in a more engaged way that we look forward to and that we respect. And finally, both of those websites have what we call a donate button. It's your way, if you are so inclined, to help us pay for the cost of the research, pay for the cost of those videos that we maintain on the websites, pay for the cost of the websites, etc. Our costs are not enormous, but they require us to do fundraising, since all of us are basically in this because we believe in what this program is trying to do. So we ask for your support, and we want to explain that while we encourage you to support the local radio station that brings this program to you, that is a separate matter from supporting us through the websites. What we really urge you at this time of the year is to ask yourselves if you can throw a little bit towards both your local station and us through those websites. Finally, there is a way for you to partner with us beyond that. The social media that you use anyway, Facebook, Twitter, and whatever else, Tumblr and so on, that you find congenial. These are ways to tell people about what you hear on this program, to make them aware of this program. Please help us to reach more people. And social media are the spectacular new ways of doing that. If you circulate materials from us, then people will recirculate those to their friends, to their associates. It's an extraordinarily wonderful way for you to partner with us, to bring us to the attention of more people so that we can bring more people into the awareness that this program is devoted to produce. So thank you for listening and for whatever along these lines you can do. The first major topic for today is an example of corruption. There's no other way to put it. It happened last week. I don't want to spend a great deal of time on it. I give you examples from time to time about the buying of our political system. But over the last 2 weeks, we passed a budget that will cover the United States federal government until September of next year. It had in it an abomination that absolutely needs to be known by everybody. For a long time, we have not regulated our financial sector very well. In the wake of the collapse of 2007 and 2008, we departed from that. We passed a bill called the Dodd-Frank bill. It didn't impose the kinds of restrictions on banks and financial companies that it should have, but it was defended, particularly by Barney Frank, the congressman who has his name on the bill, as at least a step in the right direction. Sad to say, it's become less of a step in the last 4 years. Significant parts of it have been watered down. Significant parts of it remain to have the regulations written so that it becomes effective. And now it has simply been eviscerated. There's no other word for it. It's a sad commentary. The banks that were supposed to be regulated have worked overtime to make sure the regulation is minimal and shrinking, and they have prevailed. And this last couple of weeks was an extreme, grotesque example. A Midwestern congressman, and it doesn't matter what his name was, inserted into the final budget bill a portion, an amendment, turns out to have been written by Citigroup, one of the money center banks in New York City. It wrote, apparently, and did the research for much of it. This is now typical that these lobbyists do the work and simply have the congressman be the lackey who gets the last step done. This congressman was willing to do that. And here's what this amendment says, that risky speculation in derivatives by banks can be organized by them in such a way that losses are covered under the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That's the government agency that insures your bank account, or the Federal Reserve. In other words, the federal government, which was supposed to, this is one of the goals of the Dodd-Frank bill, get out of the business of insuring risky bank behavior of the sort that led to the crisis. The whole point was to get the government out of it. Instead, what this amendment did, and it's now the law of the United States, was to give those banks what they want: the ability to engage in risky speculation, the profits of which they keep. But if they do again to the world economy what they did in 2008, the government will bail them out. It is exactly the opposite of what the vast majority of the American people want. So it's very important simply to say that we have seen Republicans and Democrats pass together a budget that includes a direct contradiction of what a majority of the people have wanted since 2008. It just doesn't matter, because those with the money can buy the politics they need. And unless and until the people of this country say no, this situation will continue. All right, let me turn to the second major topic for today, and that has to do with inequality in the United States. But this time, not the inequality of income, but the inequality of wealth. And let me explain, so we're all on the same page, what I mean. Income is the money that flows to you. It's your weekly check. It's your monthly salary payment, whatever it is. The money that comes to you every so often. Wealth is different. Wealth is the value of whatever it is you own. It's not coming to you. It's already yours. It's the value you have. And the economists keep a statistic called your net worth. And this is a measurement of your wealth. That's really what it means. It counts up your assets, your home, your car, your bank account, stocks and bonds if you have them, and so on. And it subtracts from that your debts. So the end result is kind of what is the wealth left that is actually yours, net of or including the debts and subtracted away from it. So it's really what you have. And I wanted to make sure that we all understood how wealth is distributed in the United States. And before I go over the numbers with you, let me drive home a couple of points about it. How you feel about your life, how you feel about the economic conditions of your life, are shaped by the income that's coming to you week by week, month by month, but also by whatever wealth you have. So to be simple, if you don't have much income, that could be a problem, unless you have a lot of wealth. And even if you have a nice income flow, if you have no wealth, what happens if you get sick? What happens if you get divorced? What happens if you lose your job? What happens if the economy goes south, etc.? So wealth is something as important in its way as is income. We've talked often, and I'm sure many of you know, that the income gap between rich and poor has gotten dramatically wider over the last 30 to 40 years. Dramatically, the gap between rich and poor. The middle class is in terrible trouble because it either has dropped out of the middle or that middle has become more and more pinched, whereas the folks in the top 10%, and even more those in the top 5%, and even more the famous 1%, they've been doing real well in terms of the flow, the income they get. But I want now to talk about wealth, not income. What you own, the value of what you have minus the debts that you owe. Okay, so let's begin. The median wealth of Americans. So median, again, means 50% had more, 50% had less. Median wealth, net worth of the American household in 2007 was $135,000. The wealth, 50% of Americans had less than that. Right? 50% had more. Median wealth of Americans. In 2013, so 6 years later, 2007, before the crisis hits, 2013, today, or last year, for which we have numbers, the median wealth of Americans dropped from that $135,000 in 2007 to $82,000 in 2013. That is a staggering drop. No recovery at all. For example, between 2010 and 2013, those are the last 3 years during which we were told we have a recovery, the wealth of Americans, the median wealth, didn't change at all. It was $82,000 in 2010, it's $82,000 in 2013. And those 82s in 2010 and 13 are way below what it was in 2007. So there's no recovery. There is a collapse, a major historic drop in the median wealth of the American family. But if you think that's remarkable, well, I got news for you. Because what's even more remarkable is the fact that if you break down American families and you divide them into white, black, and Hispanic, the way the government does, you get even more statistical amazing results. And by the way, I use here the research of something called the Pew, P-E-W, Charitable Trust. They are a source of excellent statistical research. And they have a report on wealth inequality dated December 12th of 2014. If you have the time to check out, you can get it on the internet. Kochar and Fry are the two authors, Rakesh Kochar and Richard Fry. December 12th, Wealth Inequality is the title, Pew Charitable Trusts, PEW. Okay. The white family wealth dropped by 30% or more than. Black dropped by 40%. Hispanic dropped by 40%. In other words, the gap between rich and poor over the last years of this crisis has gotten worse. This is the important message I want to get to you. But the numbers are staggering. The net worth of a black household in the United States, median, so 50% of African-American families did better, 50% did worse. That's what median means. The ratio of white to black in 2007 was 10 to 1. In other words, if the median white family had $100,000, it was more than that, but just for numerical sense, then the median black family had $10,000. I want people to understand 10 to 1. In 2013, the relationship between white and black, both of which had deteriorated, but the black much more, was 13 to 1. And with Hispanics, the story is the same. From 8 to 1, white to Hispanic, to 10 to 1, white to Hispanic. In other words, everyone in America lost wealth dramatically, huge numbers, a quarter, a third, almost half of your wealth gone in 5 years, even if it took you 20 to build it up. But not only did everybody's wealth shrink, but the gap between white Americans on the one hand and black and Hispanic Americans on the other, African American and Hispanic families, got worse. And here's the punchline, if indeed that's the word. Are we really surprised when we put white African American and Hispanic American families under this kind of pressure, removing in a short number of years a massive proportion of their wealth, whether that wealth be modest or even substantial? Everybody's under the gun. Everybody's wealth has shrunk. Everybody has less as the rainy day fund to handle life's changes, life's emergencies, life's crises. Of course, everybody's under pressure. But if on top of it, you widen the gap between the white part of America, which is shrinking as a portion of our population, and the African American and Hispanic, which is increasing as a proportion, you have a recipe for social conflict, social tension, social envy, social bitterness. Ferguson, Mr. Garner in New York, all of them, these are symptoms of an economic system that has unloaded its negativity on the United States, Western Europe, and Japan in a stunning and unrelenting way. My only conclusion to offer you is don't turn a blind eye to the economics of what's going on. The recovery affects a tiny sliver at the top. If you take a look at the top 10% of the people, their net worth has gone up because they're at the top. They're not affected by the median, the midpoint. That's got nothing to do with them. Their net worth has gone up dramatically. They've done well. They're the ones talking about the recovery because they're the ones who own the media. They're the ones who own the big companies. They're the ones who are collecting the big bonuses. Of course, there's a recovery for them. Their only mistake is to imagine and then to say publicly that the recovery they experience is a recovery for the economy as a whole. That's not true. There's no subtlety here. There's no nuance. It's just not true. That's why the numbers on wealth, the collapse of wealth for everybody, the vast majority, except for those at the top, the collapse of wealth and the growing divide between whites on the one hand and African American and Hispanic Americans on the other. It's unjust, it's unfair, and it provokes social conflict that is dangerous for everyone. We can't ask the police to solve this problem. They have neither the tools, nor the training, nor the understanding to do it. And to throw them into these situations is a recipe for disaster. This is a fundamental economic problem in large part. It's not all there is to it, but it's a major part. And if you don't deal with the economic inequality and the fact of the crisis of capitalism and its impact, you are not dealing with a major part of the problem, which doesn't suggest that the solution is going to work, does it? In conclusion, at this holiday time of the year, let me ask you again if you wouldn't be so kind as to partner with us. Send this program around. Go to our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Use social media, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, to share what you've learned, what you found interesting with others so they can begin to listen and they can share. And if you can, hit our donate buttons on either of the websites. Help the station that brings you this program and help us to continue in the new year to provide this kind of analysis on an ongoing basis. Thank you in advance, and I look forward to seeing and being with you again.
Won't be long, things gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Things gonna change, things gonna change. Change, change, change. Things gonna change. For the home up the road, baby. Thing gonna change, 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 baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.